My name's Dale, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'd like to ask you for a moment of silence and gratitude for AA recoveries in the past 75 years. My name is Dale. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I was very pleased to be asked to chair this meeting today. I was much more pleased to be asked to chair it than to be a speaker. I'm grateful that I found three people who would do it. The reason I got asked is because I'm the executive director of a group called International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous. For those of you who have not heard of IDAA, this is a group that was founded in 1949. It was, I'm told, the first of the special interest groups in AA. So it was founded 10 years after the Big Book was published, 14 years after the organization was founded in Akron, and currently has about 6,000 members worldwide. We have an annual meeting every year. Last year it was here in San Antonio, so we got to test this town out before all of you got here. This year it's in Buffalo. We have an active internet group that meets, that provides meetings on a regular basis. We have some slightly doctors have some slightly different issues. I know there's a lot of people in AA, probably some of you in this room, whose journey into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous began with a greeting by a police officer or a judge. Ours tend to begin, a lot of them, with greetings by retired police officers and retired judges, serving as either investigators for or hearing officers for their respective state boards of medicine. Who suggest that probably something ought to be. And very few of us come through without being involved, because for many of us, maintaining sobriety maintaining our license is contingent upon the maintenance of our sobriety. So we have a fairly structured recovery. I'm very grateful to be here. I'm grateful that all of you came. If any of you have any other questions or things, we have a hospitality room across the street. It's the hardest hospitality room to get to, I think, of any of them. You have to go over, you have to take special elevators down to the parking. We're at parking level one. We're the only room down there, okay? So it's hard to get to, but we would welcome you to come if you have questions. There's not only the International Doctors in AA, but the Nurse Anesthetists and Alcoholics Anonymous, Social Workers and Alcoholics Anonymous, psychologists, pharmacists. I didn't mention. Let me go back to that. International Doctors in AA includes among its membership physicians, dentists, veterinarians, pharmacists, basically anyone who has a doctoral level degree in healthcare. Basically, folks that have to have a license. With that, I'm grateful to have the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm going to pass our first speaker today is Chuck R., who's right from here in San Antonio. Chuck?
Morning. My name is Chuck, and I am an alcoholic. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair, right? You know, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the play Dr. Bob and Bill W. and Dr. Bob. I was in San Antonio this past week. And Dr. Bob the guy who played Dr. Bob has a very, very facile face. And what he does when the word greater, higher power or God comes, he goes, "Yeah!" And I must confess that when all of that stuff started, that's how I felt. And I don't know if you've not gone to that, that play, you should. It's marvelous. Secondly, if you weren't there last night, some people weren't, but I mean, I've waited 10 years. My sobriety date is the 29th of July, 2000. My home group is Colonies North Group here in San Antonio. I'm a veteran graduate, so to speak, of the Springbrook Treatment Center in Newburgh, Oregon, that gave me assistance when I needed assistance 10 years ago. But I've waited 10 years to say the Lord's Prayer with 55,000 people. And let me tell you something. It's amazing. And on the top of that, to sing Amazing Grace, I don't sing very well anyway, but that was tremendous. Now, I got to tell you that my grandiosity needs to be identified early on, all right? You may have noticed that. Dale called me up and said, would you speak at the international meeting? And I said, well, of course. Of course. And then, okay, then the, this is the alcoholic in me, right? And then the program comes out, and I'm finding out where I'm supposed to be, and I'm seeing the room that I'm supposed to be, and I couldn't figure out what the parenthesis was. There's a number in parenthesis. And I couldn't figure out what that was. So, you know where I'm going with this, right? And so, I finally decided to look a little further. You know how we are, we don't like to take directions, and we don't like to look too hard to find something out. So, it took a while, and I finally realized that the number in parenthesis was the room capacity. Now, the room capacity here is 270, all right? Now, my grandiosity tells me 270 people? Now, I have much more to give away than that. All right? Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I got sober not because I had any spiritual awakening, not because I wanted to, but the state of Texas and the Department of Public Safety, undercover narcotic agents, and the Drug Enforcement Agency made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Now, some of you may have been there before, right? Some. I also want to point out that there is an undercover attorney in this gathering. A friend of mine, Eduardo, is here making sure that I stay honest. He used to work for the EA. Well, I mean, I don't. But these guys came to see me one day, and, you know, by that time, I had done everything. I mean, it was 10 years ago now. And to be where I was 10 years ago and stand up here and to have been there last night is nothing short of miraculous. Nothing short of miraculous, which is an understatement. All right? We say that all the time. It's a miracle I'm here. Well, it is. It just is. I had done everything that you're supposed to do to qualify for this program. You know, I mean, I had no boundaries anymore. Now, that's a big word for some of you. But I was trying to put the make on one of my patients, and it was July 3rd. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do July 4th because I had run out of options, and I had to go there. And that was pretty sorry. But I did, and that's what I was doing. And I could not drink. I could not take pills. I could not do anything except run roughshod through somebody's life. I ran through your life. I ran through my patients' lives. I did all the things that we have done. Now, I have come to learn, as I have become sober, sometimes dry, sometimes sober, right? You know the term crinkly? Crinkly is what happens when you get like that. And if you haven't been there, you will be. And that's when you... It sort of happens to me when I don't go to enough meetings. It sort of happens to me when I don't pay attention to what got me here. The people that I screwed over, so to speak, had gotten to the point where people were talking, people were reporting me. And finally, I showed up at a drugstore that, interestingly enough, God has a sense of humor, sits catty-corner from my current home group. And that's a fact. I rolled in there, and I picked up my final prescription. I was one of those guys who wrote my own prescriptions. I didn't feel that I needed to bother you. So I had, as you know, some of you may not know this, but I just called myself up, or called him up, and I said, look, I'm Dr. Roth, I want to give myself a prescription, would you fill it for me, sure, what do you need, and I told him, and I went by, and I had about five or six of them I would rotate, because I didn't want to look too familiar. But the guy looked at me, the pharmacist looked at me, this was sometime in the early part of June 2000, the guy looked at me, and he looked at me again, he looked at the prescription again, and he looked at me and he says, you know, you seem to take a lot of these. And I said, you're right. And the little light came on, and that's exactly when I knew that I was in trouble. And 6 weeks later, the DEA and everybody came in, and that was it. But that's how it worked. I'm sitting today, when I go to my home group, And every time I make a right-hand turn to go to my home group, I look at the same building where the guy said to me, you take too many of these. And that is God's way of telling me. I never got arrested. I was never thrown in jail, et cetera, et cetera. And I used to say I was just lucky. I used to say I managed well. You know how it goes? We suffered under the delusion that we would do well if we only managed well. Well, I managed well. But I realize today that that was grace. I was given grace. I've learned that. I'm one of these guys that had to learn to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. Now, that was difficult, but it wasn't. It just took a long time. I mean, my first time I ever got a copy of the Big Book was 1979. In 1979, I said to this friend of mine, I think I drink too much. And he looked at me and he said, here, read this. What was that? So I did the next right thing. I read the doctor's opinion. Right? It seemed appropriate that I read the doctor's opinion. And this is the God's truth. I got down to the point where it said, we think you have an allergy. And I said, I don't have an allergy. I'm not allergic to anything. Closed the book and that was it. Because I was dramatically relieved that I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I wasn't allergic to anything. I mean, after all, it's a doctor's opinion, right? I'm a doctor. I read what's in the opinion, New England Journal, etc. I got that amount of grace, and I proceeded to go to treatment. And I was in treatment, and you know how those places are. Maybe if you don't, you do. One time the guy said to me, you have to go do this. And I started doing that, and I'm studying. And he walks by later, and he says, you don't have to get an A in recovery. Oh. Because I suffered under that business that I needed all the self-knowledge. I needed to gain all the self-knowledge. And I figured I could figure it out. And it took a long time. And not in treatment to point out to my mind that I didn't have all the answers. I didn't have all the answers, and something was going to happen. So I left the treatment center, and I came back to San Antonio. And I started going to AA meetings. 9 years later, sitting in here, listening to speakers, and listening to all that I've listened to over the last 9 years, I realize that I'm just barely scratching the surface. I have had a wonderful time in sobriety. Nothing bad has happened. I got married in sobriety. That's amazing. I'm in a monogamous relationship for the first time in my entire life. That may be nothing to you guys, but it's a big deal to me. It's a real big deal to me. And the only fly in the ointment is I don't go to Al-Anon. Sorry, Mary Lou. Mary Beth. I have gotten married in sobriety. I'm in practice. I still am in practice. I quit doing all the things that I used to do. I'm a cardiologist. I used to put in everything that you could possibly put into whatever tube place you want. And I was doing it in the middle of the night. I was doing it whether I was drunk, whether I was sober, whether I was... By the way, if you ever go to the emergency room and your doctor shows up with a mask, it's not because he's got a cold, all right? I've done that. I mean, I used to sit in my office and nod off, and my poor patients would think that I was working so hard, all right? You ever been there? You're sitting in the office, and the patient's talking, and it becomes more and more monotonous, and all of a sudden, I can't remember what he said because I've nodded off, and he's looking at me. That happened to me a lot of times. That doesn't happen to me anymore. Patient comes into my office, and I speak to them, and I sit down, and I have a relationship with them. And they get 100% of me that moment. Now, that's an amazing gift for me to sit here and be able to give them 100% of me. That's amazing. I have been able and blessed to participate in my home group. I have people that I sponsor. I have a guy that works with me. He's my sponsor. And I've stayed sober. Now, if you're like I am, and 10 years go by, maybe for you guys, a lot longer. Things get better. I get a job back. I get the relationship. I'm being able to pay for the mortgage. The heat's off, right? Life gets better. Complacency can easily set in. I've been blessed because of participation in my home group, participation last year in IDAA, participation in this year, that complacency has not been an issue. I always ask people when they go out, what happened? Well, I don't know what happened. I quit going to meetings. I guess the idea of having a drink sounded good. I don't want to be there. I also don't want to be in the situation that I have felt that I've been before in the last 10 years where people will look at me and they'll say, why don't you go get drunk? I mean, you know, angry, discontent, lonely, fearful. The things that happen to me in sobriety are easily and more easily handled by non-substantive abuse, so to speak, than they used to be. I'm able to talk to some people about it. But if you're like I am and you're a self-sufficient, egotistical, grandiose doctor, talking to somebody else about it is not the easiest thing in the world. To come up and make myself vulnerable to you and say, you know what, I'm scared to death that such and such is going to happen. I mean, I'm going to be 69 this year. I'm supposed to be at the zenith of my career. I like to say that I'm at the zenith of an otherwise mediocre career kind of thing, or the downhill slide. And I used to say that to make light of it, but I was really afraid that what was going to happen to me. And I sit and I look back and see what's happened to me in the last 10 years as a result of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, as a result of participating in the program. It's amazing. I have added years to my career time. I've added years to my personal time. Dr. Bob, in his story, and this happens to me, this has happened to me, he says, I have regained my health. I have regained my self-respect. I have regained the respect of my colleagues. My home life is ideal. And my business is as good as can be expected in today's uncertain times. And he writes that. And he wrote that when? 1939? Okay, here we sit. 2010. Healthcare is in an uproar. It's an outside issue, but that's all right. It affects me. If it affects me, it's not an outside issue, right? Did you ever think of it that way? Yes. But these are uncertain times. And if you're a drunk like I am, uncertain times lead to the idea that something's going to have to change. And when something's going to have to change, oh, shit. Right? The wonderful news is that I can show up with and be one of 55,000+ people sitting in an auditorium, say the Lord's Prayer, and realize that it's okay. And, you know, I didn't think one second last night about me, which is hard to believe, all right? I didn't even worry last night about what I was going to say today, which is even more incredible. But I don't know about you guys, but it gives me great pleasure to be part of and just be one person in a room, even though I complain about the seating capacity, right? Even one person in one room, part of one giant whole. And that giant hole is something that was given to me free of charge. I mean, I paid for it, and we all paid for it, but who cares? It was free of charge. And all I have to do is show up. And I'm very grateful. San Antonio is a place that I never would have ever selected to live. In 1971, when I came to this city, I was sent here because in those days, they used to have a draft. And in those days, every doctor went in the service whether he had one leg, two legs, or no eyes. You were in the service. And that's what happened to me. My first orders were at Shepherd Air Force Base in North Texas. You crossed the Red River and you hit the red dirt, and it was awful. And my first orders came to San Antonio, Texas, and I didn't know where in the hell San Antonio, Texas was. I didn't even know the Alamo was here. But I've been here ever since. I've watched San Antonio grow. I've watched a lot of things occur in this city. I've stayed alive. I've had good things, bad things. and I've never been more grateful to be where I am today. I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Pleasure of hearing Chuck speak last year at IDAA, and that's why I wanted to be sure we asked him to come this year. Our next speaker is Kim H. from Seattle, Washington.
Hi, family. My name is Kim, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why they asked me to speak, because I don't know what I'm going to say. So I'll just tell you what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. The first time that I can remember drinking, I was 12 or 13, and I was hanging out with the big kids. A lot of times they say you'll be restored to sanity, and I wondered, what would that mean? What would that mean for me to be restored to sanity? Because I can't remember being sane. The first time I left home, anybody here from New York, I grew up in Woodside, in the Woodside Projects, and I was 5 years old, and I decided that Aunt Lee's house was a better place to be, and so I walked to Corona. And my mother and my father were, what could you be thinking? But, you know, by then I was out of there. That was the kind of house that I grew up in. And my drinking was ruined by AA when I was a little kid. You know, one of the statistics that they say is that if you are in recovery and you stay in recovery and you have children, they may still drink, but you may lose that last 10 to 15 years of literal hell because they can watch what you're doing. And we're the big book that our kids see. And I saw my mom and my dad, and my mom never hid the disease. And so I knew, he's an alcoholic, throw the bum out. So so when I started drinking at 12, I wanted to control my drinking. So already it wasn't fun. So when I, because AA had already messed up my drinking. So by the time I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was already trying to control my drinking from the very first drink. You know, I never wanted to be an alcoholic. And so I wasn't. I married one. And, And he wasn't an alcoholic until he got with me. He was straight as an arrow. And then he met me. And I introduced him to a lot of things. And we went off to college together. That was a geographic. And but back up a little bit. So between 12 and 18... I wanted to get out of the house again, and I had to have a plan for how to get out of the house. And so the first thing I wanted, this was the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, and the first thing I wanted was a scholarship to summer camp. And so I'd read the New York Times and see how could I get a scholarship to summer camp. But that didn't work. So then I thought, okay, I'm just going to graduate and go to college. And so I applied to college, and I got accepted to a couple of schools, but they said I was too young, and I had to wait a year. And that was in 69. And in 1969, codependent that I was, the cool guys were carrying rifles around my town and shooting up the neighborhood. And so I wanted to be with the cool guys, and so I went along because that's what I did, follow the guys. And I followed them right into a riot, and I got shot up. And I also went to jail. That was my one time going to jail. I was 15, and they let me out because I was 15. And so I didn't get to go to college. When I applied again, by the time I applied again, I was a single parent. So I got to go to welfare. And so I was on welfare, but I want to tell you about my gynecologist. this will tie in, and I'll tell you why. Okay, so you think that people don't know about your family, but they do. And what they know is really important stuff. Like my gynecologist, what I knew was that his son was an addict, and that he was having a hard time with that. But so that's the kind of stuff. The other thing that I knew about doctors in town, because I come from a really small town in Massachusetts, was that if you are having trouble with your lights being turned off, the doctors can prevent it, and they can write a letter that says that you can have electricity. And I thought, when I grow up, electricity, that's it, that's what I want, you know. I'm going to be able to write those letters so people can have electricity, because we didn't have electricity all the time because my dad didn't pay the bills. So I go, now I'm pregnant, and I go to see my gynecologist, and I'm eating, what was I eating? Chinese food and banana split every day. And so I get into his office, and he says, "You've gained 10 pounds in the last week. Are you out of your mind? What are you eating?" I told him, Chinese food and banana splits. when I had my daughter, I remember that I wasn't married, so you couldn't have your partner in the room with you. So here I am, now I'm 16, and I'm just loud and rowdy and screaming for him. And he comes in, and he delivers my daughter, and all I heard was, "Oh, shit," because she was yellow, and she about near died, and she had these really little things on the side of her head that I thought was so cute. When I got into medical school, I realized it was the forceps pulling her out. I'm so blessed. I drank for every day. By then I was a revolutionary, and I was in the Black Panther Party, and I was drinking every single day. And they put me to bed because I started to lose her. And that was what saved her, was that I went to bed. So they had to get her out, and they got her out. And then, but my doctor, he talked to me every time I went. He spent over half an hour with me, just talking. And how do you talk to an alcoholic? You just talk to him. You don't have to say anything. I wanted to be like him, you know. He was the first person that was really kind to me, you know. And I looked up his obit this morning before I came, you know, and he's gone. But you don't know. You don't know. I mean, what we did to him was really bad. So we put in an IUD. You can think why. And we put in a Dalcon shield. And so what we did to the poor guy was it was painful. And I and five other people barged in his office. So you can imagine, there's everybody with their black berets and like this, you know, telling him, "Get it out now." You know what I mean? Just disrupted the whole thing, right? This guy was cool. I mean, he was. I'm sure his partners couldn't stand me, but he was wonderful. But like I say, and I thought all doctors were like him. And when I got my next gynecologist, I got a woman, and I thought she's going to be really wonderful, but she wasn't. But I think that what he had was a heart. He had a heart, you know. And the other thing that happened about that time was that people said to me, "You know, you could go back to school. You could go back to school." Every time somebody saw me, they said, "You know, what are you doing? You could go to school." So meanwhile, I was working in Free Health Center in Boston, and what I was doing in between drinking and passing my daughter off on my parents was scrubbing the floors of the community health center. It was just a little building. And so I looked at the medical students, and I said, "They're no smarter than I am. I could do this." And so I did. And yeah, well, I was still drinking, still drugging. And fast forward into medical school, and I don't know why nobody picked it up, but maybe because I was moderating, you know. I never wrote my own prescription, because I knew that if you write your own prescription, you're an addict. And so, what I would do is when things got really, really heavy, I would just go to the emergency room. And I would say, I'm a medical student, and I'm a single parent. And it's really hard right now. Can I have maybe 3 Valiums? And I would get them, you know. And that would be enough, because I never wanted to be an addict. I just wanted enough. That's all I want. I just wanted enough to take the edge off. But I will tell you that the next time I came into AA, I went to my first meeting when I was 18. When I was 18, with a friend of mine who was an AA speaker, and he was a really good friend. Really good. And so he took me to a meeting, and then he took me out to eat, because I'd flashed my legs at him. And he took me out to eat, and he asked me what I wanted to drink, and I drank like my dad. So we're in this really fancy restaurant in Rhode Island, and I'd never been in a fancy, the kind where they give you the wine and you're supposed to like taste it and give it back, but I didn't know that, because my wine all came like a Bally High, you know, Mad Dog. That's what I drank, you know. And so here we are in this, and we are in this restaurant, and he says, you're supposed to, okay, so I asked for a 7 and 7. So he said, well, I'm going to teach you how to drink like a lady. And so I found out that's in the Big Book. It was a long time later that I found out that, you know, I could learn how to drink like a lady. Well, but, you know, he didn't identify me either. When I got sober, fast forward, I had a moment of clarity once when in college, when my daughter was 4, and I came in through the back door of Al-Anon, you guys. I was not an alcoholic when I met my husband. He was. And at any rate, so he was my prey, and I followed him wherever he went. Lois talks in the Big Book about how we drink with them, and that's what I did. They would go to the Rathskeller, and I would go to the Rathskeller. And we'd go on Friday night, and they would drink. And if I wanted to be with these guys, I would have to drink too. So I drank. But, see, I couldn't hold my liquor, so then it would be time to go home. And I'd go home, and I'd pick up my daughter, and I'd bring her home, and I'd be ready to crash. I'd be able to munch and crash. And one day she looked at me with those big eyes, and she said, Mama, I'm not tired. It's like 6 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, I'm ready to go to sleep. And I never passed out. I just went to sleep. And so... So what I said was, I'm not going to drink in the Rathskeller anymore. You know, I'm not going to drink. And so, I kept moderating. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to Al-Anon. And another thing about drinking is that people know. So I intervened on my husband, and we were back at home. I was working and he was drinking, and he went to treatment, and so then he went to AA, and the first meeting I went to with him, everybody said, oh, Dr. Allen, are you one of us? I said, no, I'm him. I am with him. And but I should have said, yes, I'm one of us, you know, but I wasn't. I was in Al-Anon. I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and everybody there had white hair, and they were old. And and at the end of the meeting, and I talked, and I was crazy. I mean, I was absolutely crazy. I mean, literally crazy. And they just looked at me. I'm the kind of person that would come in the meeting, and people would just look at you and know you were nuts. And it's true. I am not exaggerating, and not exaggerating at all. But what I decided was that Al-Anon was not for me, and so I went away. But then I came out. Now I'm in residence. Well, yeah. So I came back out to Seattle, and I went to an Adult Children of Alcoholics treatment center, because that was the problem, in South Dakota. And what they said to me at the end was, why don't you try a few AA meetings when you get back to Seattle? but no. So I decided to divorce my husband, and you know, it's so funny. I can laugh today. I love it. And I decided to divorce my husband. I wanted to divorce him really good, and so I hired an AA lawyer. And the lawyer, it turns out, was the husband of my husband's counselor in the treatment center. But I didn't know that until years later. And what he said to me was, I'd love for you to meet my wife because you really like her. And she took me to my first AA meeting, and I said, gee, I wish I was an alcoholic because I relate so well to what everybody's saying in here. But I don't drink. But by then I had stopped drinking. And she took me to Bellevue Women's, 8 o'clock Saturday morning. And I feel the way these people do. You know, I wish I could stay. She says, okay, you just keep coming back. It's all right. You can come. It was an open meeting. So, but I can't be an alcoholic because I'm not drinking right now. And with the rest of the time, I want to tell you what it's like to be tinderbox dry in AA because I did that for 20 years. And it's death. I think we kill people if we don't take them through the steps right as soon as they come in and they're half dead. Because I was nuts. I was nuts. You know, that childhood that I had and being shot up, if I heard a car backfire, it was like this, you know. I mean, I had PTSD. And when I talk about being restored to sanity, when I got sober, it was not the answer, you know. I'm one of these people that got sober at 23rd and Cherry in Fremont. And it's very hard for me to talk without four-letter words about what it was like, people. I'm working it here. When I got sober, I mean, it was three meetings a day. And meanwhile, I'm a workaholic, so I'm working 110 hours a week, and my little brother, I'm calling him on the phone telling him I'm getting sober, and I got to go to AA, but how am I going to find time? And he said, Kim, there's 24 hours in the day, and if you just use that 1 hour and a half to go to AA, the other 23 will be okay. It'll be okay. But I got to tell you, that was not the answer for me. I went to AA. I waited a year. I got a new man. I had another kid. You know, they warned me. They said things like, stay out of those discussion meetings. Go to the step study. Get in the big book. Go to the newcomer meetings. That's where you need to be. But I was a newcomer. I'd been to ACA treatment. I knew about it. So I didn't. I didn't listen. And then I substituted, and I got depressed, and I was on the medications, and then the flashbacks started coming, and I had to have a... So I'm the kind of person that back then, if I went into a code, I would be in SVT, but... literally, I was in SVT. And so I'm having a panic attack, but see... Being a doctor, right, they say, okay, do you see this, right? Me, an alcoholic, right? They say, okay, can you see this? And I go, uh-huh. But can I really see it? Uh-uh. A lie. Lie, lie, lie. That was, and anything that was going on, I knew I couldn't tell anyone. So I couldn't tell anybody that I was having what I thought were panic attacks. Later on, what I found out was that I needed an endocardial ablation because I really was having SVT. But, you know, but if you don't tell anybody, nobody's going to know. So, when I got shot up in this riot, there were four people, and one guy died, and another guy died later, and then there was me, and I still have the shrapnel in here, and who shot us was these three white guys, and so now I'm going to go and have this endocardial ablation with these three white guys. So that through that, I started having like flashbacks and hallucinations. I'm sharing this because, in meanwhile, I was able to cut one life. We alcoholics, we lead a double life, you know. And when I finally decided I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink. People said to me, "You're an alcoholic? You think you're an alcoholic?" And it wasn't until I worked the steps about that other stuff, that Al-Anon stuff, and realized that the problem is I'm powerless. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I can't manage a decision and not drink. It's not that I'm a doctor that... It's not that I'm a doctor that happens to be an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic that happens to be a doctor. You know? I'm just an alcoholic that happens to be a doctor. So, and now I know that... I drank again going to 90 and 90. It's not 90 and 90. It's not don't drink, don't drug, and go to meetings. It's my purpose is now that I've been given the power to recover and not hallucinate and not drink and not drug, you know, it's to pass that on, to find somebody else who maybe is out there and doesn't know what to do. I know how to stay sober no matter what is going on, no matter what I'm seeing, no matter what I'm hearing, who's dying, who's living, you know. Yeah, I get to be here. Thank you, guys.
Our last speaker is Dick McKinley. I'm sure I can use his last name because he's had the same job that I've had. He was executive director of IDA for many years. Dick was from St. Louis, now from California. Dick?
My name's Dick. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic in recovery and a grateful member of Al-Anon. Wow. Thanks, Kim and Chuck and Dale. When I got here in my seat, I wrote down Dale, Chuck, Kim, Dick. I know who was up here. I wrote it down. So my name is Dick. I'm an alcoholic and a grateful member of Al-Anon, and in the Texas tradition, my sobriety dates 25th of January 1980. My sponsor's name is Dan. I met with him Tuesday. My home group's the Sunrise Celebrators Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Portola Street Fellowship Hall in Palm Desert, California, 6 a.m., 6 days a week. I don't go to all those meetings. I mean, in California, they go to meetings all the time. I mean, but I didn't start out in California, so I don't have to follow that, you know, kind of path. I sobered up in Minnesota, that's later part of the story. I want to congratulate Dale and Mary Beth for the great job they're doing in IDAA. It's not easy being the executive director of International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous because you're on call 24/7, maybe 26/8, because people call at all hours of the day and night, and they don't want to talk to a recording. They don't want to they want to talk to somebody, and they want to talk for quite a while, and they are unique because they're MDs. The MDity in us is a hard thing to outgrow. They jumped in with both feet. They're fully committed to carrying the message. And communication now is a lot faster and maybe a little bit more impolite and pushy than it used to be. But they're there doing their thing day in and day out. In a few months, International Doctors and AA will be meeting in Buffalo for the 60th meeting. Dale told you that. And I'm going to be doing a history along with Gordy Hyde, who was the last executive director. He's spearheading the effort to do a history of International Doctors and AA, and I'm going to be helping him. And I really, Gordy, if you get a copy of this tape, I'm sorry that I've been so slow in getting my stuff done. That's not a prompt amend. past and part then seemed to be a slower time when I was doing IDAA things and things weren't going at the rapid rate that they're going now. I had an intervention at the Johnson Institute in Minneapolis. I was president of the Minnesota Urological Society at the time I had my intervention. And when my partners took me to my intervention, my wife invited my two senior partners to the intervention, and they thought they were taking an innocent man to be hanged. You know, hell, they thought my wife was daft. And so they sat in that intervention, and my son had come back from the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio, to be there for my intervention. And when I saw his coat hanging in the hallway, his jacket, I knew the jig was up. But I didn't really understand what was going on at first. But my four children told me about the effect my drinking had on them and on the family. And my 10-year-old daughter made the diagnosis. She said, "Daddy, you're an alcoholic, and I want you to go get help." And I thought, I'll go, and then I'll come back, and I'll learn how to drink like a gentleman. Who was talking about wine? I had a wine cellar in our basement, and I lived on Lake Harriet, and I had a temperature-controlled wine cellar, 500 bottles laying down in little and racks, you know, so the little label hanging off there, the neck, so I didn't have to pull the bottle out and tip it up to read it. You know, I knew what was in there, and that was, I had great intentions about that wine. You know, my wife and I would do vertical tastings of a chateau, you know, and I knew a lot about wine. I also had a case down on the floor that when I'd pull the cork, I'd take a drink out of it and see how, a lot of sediment usually, so you'd have to let it sit a while. But then I'd take another drink and I'd put the cork on and I'd stick it up on the shelf. But otherwise, I was a wine connoisseur. there's an orthopedic surgeon in Minneapolis, his name is Bud, who ran some of the IDAA meetings when we had an international meeting at IDAA in Minneapolis. And he said, "I wasn't a connoisseur, I was a common sewer." and I kind of relate to that. But so later on, my beautiful wife Cheryl and I'll be attending the meeting in Buffalo. And there's some other things happening this year, and some other things that have happened this year that we've done together that are meaningful to, I think, tell you about here. So we're going to be in Buffalo. I went to my first IDAA meeting in July of 1980, and I haven't missed one since. And they're wonderful, wonderful meetings. They have an individual flavor, a common program. And there's opportunity for children there. I took my four kids to Washington, D.C. for our first meeting, rented a van and drove from Minneapolis to Washington, D.C. And my four children, as a result of going to that International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous, met other children whose fathers were or mothers were physicians. And they established friendships there that have lasted till this day. And I am so fortunate because my family did an intervention on me on the 25th of January, 1980. As a result of that intervention, my four children have been able to do interventions on each other when when their disease happened along. I'd left the family. I had to move out after 5 years of recovery. When my daughter showed up at a family Thanksgiving, blitzed with her dealer boyfriend, took him 4 days to get from Iowa to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Kind of a half day trip, but they had to go to Chicago and load up on stuff. Anyway, when she showed up stoned at Thanksgiving dinner, her three brothers said, "Sister, you're going to treatment, and you're going to treatment tomorrow." So Friday after Thanksgiving, Margaret was in treatment. Carl, my oldest son, had been to treatment a couple times, and he was out, and he was wandering the streets of Minneapolis, and I used to drive up and down the streets of Minneapolis looking for Carl, and I couldn't ever find him. He didn't want to be found, so I couldn't find him. But his two brothers and sister found him, and they said, "Brother, you're going to treatment." And Carl went to treatment again, state-supported treatment, and he went to a state-supported halfway house program, and Carl's sober now. They're in NA. Thank God for NA. But my youngest son, Nathan, went to University of Wisconsin. And, of course, they drank some beer at University of Wisconsin. When I visited him at the house he was staying at, there were cases of beer, empties, stacked as higher than you could put them up there. You had to get a ladder to put the cases that high. There were three or four rows of cases like that where at the place he was staying. I thought, man, way to go, Nathan. Anyway, Nathan eventually ended up getting sober, and I had a call from him just recently. He just had a anniversary with a bunch of the buddies that he drank with, and he still goes on a weekend with people in Wisconsin, and they all drink and have a great time, and Nathan doesn't drink, and he plays golf with them and has a super time. So anyway, International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous and my intervention allowed my four children to be sober, and that's a blessing. And together we probably got darn near 100 years of sobriety if you count Cheryl's and mine and theirs, and that's a miracle. So we're going to go to Buffalo, and then Cheryl's got relatives in Germany, so we go over to visit them every once in a while. And after the meeting between the meeting in Germany and the British Doctors and Dentists meeting, which is a meeting of doctors in recovery in England, which we've gone to several times, there's a meeting of the International Society of Addiction Medicine in Milan. And I'm a member of the International Society of Addiction Medicine, and so the opportunities for fellowship around the world are amazing for doctors in recovery. This is a kiwi tie. The kiwi is a bird, and in New Zealand, we traveled through New Zealand this year. Took a 2-year trip to a 2-week trip through New Zealand, and then we went to the Australian Doctors in Recovery meeting in Sydney, and we were there on the beach and had a great time. So, American Society of Addiction Medicine meeting was earlier this year. At that meeting, there are 7 recovery meetings. There's a 7 a.m. meeting and a 10 p.m. meeting each day of the American Society of Addiction Medicine meeting. And they're 12-step meetings. People, appreciate those meetings. So anyway, I asked my sponsor about my approach, and he said, "Maybe play down the grandiosity a little bit." the entitlement, you know, the MD. I have a hard time doing that because I was president of the Minnesota Urological Society when I went into treatment. I mean, they didn't know that, but I let them know that. The senior counselor on the unit at Hazelden was name is George Weller, and he used to say, "Some of my patients are well, but I am Weller," and he was right. But he had an assistant counselor on the unit, and I got her. I mean, they gave me a woman for a counselor. And didn't they know who I was? I mean, I didn't need a woman for a counselor. I mean, I used women. They were useful, you know. I felt that way. You know, nurses were very handy on occasion. And occasionally, you know, you may have dated patients. I did date one. But I dated nurses and lab techs and x-ray techs and they were useful. And one day Marianne said to me, "I want you to tell people something that they don't know about you, something each day. Tell somebody something they don't know about you." So I told people something that they didn't know about me, and I'd tell somebody else and somebody else, and pretty soon I got the drift. They were looking for the deepest, darkest thing about me that I wasn't going to tell to anybody. So I buried that thing under a whole bunch of things people didn't know about me, and I could have still been telling people things, and they wouldn't have gotten to that thing. Except one time on a walk with a guy named John, I bottom lined with him. We were walking, and it was Minnesota, and it was February by that time, and we were on a walk, and I said, "John, there's something I got to tell you about me." And so I told John, and he stopped, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "That's a biggie." But he said, "God must still love you because he hasn't zapped you yet." And then he said, "There's something about me that isn't too pretty. You think you can handle it?" And John told me about John. And now I know John, and John knows me. He lives in Chicago. When I fly through Chicago, I call John. And sometimes he comes down to the airport and meets me. It's been 30 years since John and I were in treatment together. And John is alive and well in Chicago. He's a caterer. He caters the boxes in Soldier Field Stadium. He said, "This stuff's to sell. It's not to buy. It's not to drink." You know, he sells vodka for $30 or $40 a bottle. Anyway, before I came down here, I there's a person that I really revere out near where we live. His name is. I'll tell you his full name. His name is Jim West. Jim West did the first kidney transplant. Jim West's birthday is the 29th of March, 1914. Jim's 96 years old. He's sharp as a tack. His sobriety date is the 11th of July, 1958. He's been sober 51 years, 11 months, and about 24 days. So Jim's coming up on a birthday, and I'm going to have a card down in the room for us for later on, so you can come in and sign a happy birthday card for Jim. But Jim is as sharp as he was, I think, when he did his first kidney transplant. He was the medical director at Betty Ford for a long time. He was a surgeon, and then he got in recovery, and he's a wonderful, rich source of information and strength for me. And I called him, and I said, "I'm going to be talking to some people in Texas, and is there something that you'd say to them if you were talking to them?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "Tell them to make connection with a power greater than themselves." So make a connection with a power greater than yourself. And he said, "And after that, things play out okay." He's right. And then he said, "The best treatment, the best prescription for mental health is the 12 steps." I rest my case. Kick me when I'm supposed to quit. One of the things I get a great deal of comfort in is when I'm in a mall or something, and I get this, I see this little diagram, and there's a little star that said, "You are here." And I love to find out where I am, because that's very helpful, because I like driving somewhere. I know how to get there. We just get in the car and drive. But no, if you want to get to the shishi shop in the Lansdowne Mall, then you go to where you are here to the map, and you find out where number B19 is or whatever. Anyway. So somebody said, to know where you are, you need to know three things, four things, really. You need to know longitude, latitude, altitude, and attitude. If you're a pilot and you know attitude, you know which way you're going, up, down, sideways, So longitude, latitude, altitude, and attitude. Longitude, I was given a plaque when we moved to our new house in Palm Desert, California. I was going to get it. I was going to do it in bronze, but Cheryl went ahead and did it. If I was going to do it in bronze, I would still be going to do it in bronze. But Cheryl did it and gave it to me for a present. And it says longitude 116 degrees 25 something and 36 minutes west. Latitude 33 degrees 38 feet 12 minutes north, and altitude 3,060 feet. Attitude, gratitude. we call our place Blue Sky, and it's a neat place. We got a picture of a rainbow. It's nice to know where I am. And also, the thing I have the biggest problem with is being here now. The best way I have of knowing that I'm being here now, it happened one time with Cheryl when things were really in turmoil, and it was before we were married, and I was torn between something that happened and something that was going to happen, or something that might happen, or something that didn't happen. And so I was looking at a vein in my wrist, and I put my I kind of stripped the blood out of the vein, and I lift it up, and when I lift up the one upstream, nothing happens. I lift up the one downstream, there it comes, there it is. When I am grounded in that, I'm here now. I'm not torn between yesterday and tomorrow. I'm here, and I need that. I need that kind of immediacy sometimes, because otherwise I get lost. I've been helped by a lot of people. One of the things, I get scared. One of the things somebody said, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I refuse to pitch my tent and stay the night." Because I do that. I'm like a deer in front of headlights. I'm in the valley of the shadow, and I can't move. And the admonition is move, move to the other side of the valley. When that happens, I'm a lot better off. So movement is very important. We had a spiritual renewal center in Missouri, and we had a picnic there after, when the concept is still there, and they had a picnic, and we were there, and a man told one of the alcoholics that spoke, the husband and wife team, the man said, "My sobriety and recovery can be captured in three word sentences." He said, I was at my bottom. I didn't know what the hell to do. I got down on my knees and I said, "God help me." I called a guy and I said, I think I need help. And he said, "Are you ready?" And he, And he replied, "Yes, I am." And the guy said, "Let's get going." Now, that's the kind of recovery that I relate to. God help me. Are you ready? Yes, I am. Let's get going. Mine didn't proceed quite at that pace. But gradually, the educational variety, I grew. I've grown. I've grown through strong sponsorship. I've grown through adherence to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've grown through fifth step after fifth step after fifth step after fifth step. The man I do most of my fifth steps with, the last time I did one, said, "You know, this is the ninth fifth step we've done together." I hadn't lost count. But I can go back and say, "Well, you know about the goat when I was nine or what, whatever you have to tell." You can get real current about things. And then I had a great Al-Anon sponsor who said, "Things clarify. If you'll just stop muddying the water, if you'll just, you know, don't do something, stand there, you know, then things will clarify." And things do clarify. Lastly, I've got a sponsee in Palm Desert, California, who's in the hospital. His name is Jim. Offer up a little prayer for Jim. He's got a stone, a kidney stone that's migrated down to the uretero-pelvic junction, the uretero-vesical junction, and he's also got diverticulitis, severe diverticulitis. And he needs to have the diverticulitis operated on, and the surgeon's saying, "No, I don't want to operate till the stone gets better," and the urologist said, "I don't want to do the stone until the diverticulitis is cured." And so his internist said, "I decided that we're going to have the urologist in here and take care of that damn stone, and then we're going to do the diverticulitis." And I said, "How'd that go?" And he said, "I looked in his eyes, and I knew that was what we were supposed to do." That's the kind of sponsee I've got. He was sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous by a sponsor who was the back to basics kind of guy. Do all the steps right now. He said, "If I hadn't done all the steps right then, right now, I would not have done the steps. I would have bolted." And so now Jim wants me to help him do the steps now for other people. And so we've done that. We've done a couple of that. And last week we went through the 12 steps. We got through the first eight steps, the first nine steps, really, and we're supposed to do 10, 11, and 12. And he said, "We're going to get this done in a week. So today, they're going to do the next step." And Jim's in the hospital. He said, "I called those guys up that are supposed to come and do those steps." And he said, "I said, you get your big books and you bring them over to this hospital and you do it today." That's the kind of sponsee I get. I'm ever so grateful. There was a talk I was going to give, and there's a talk later on I'll wish I gave, but the talk I've given now is over. I'm really glad you're all here. Welcome to sobriety.
Let me find my place in the book here. One of the things I'm not going to share my story at all or my wife's story, but if there's one thing that I've gotten from the time that we've been involved with International Doctors and Alcoholics Anonymous, and really all AA programs since we've been involved, you know, beyond hoping to stay sober ourselves and get our lives straight, the one thing that I've heard repeatedly is, "I'd like to break the cycle of this disease for my children." I've heard that time and time again. I can share with you just a bit of our personal experience, strength, and hope. My wife and I we started drinking together. We stopped drinking together. We have the same sobriety date. We managed to stay married through all that. Don't ask me how. We had two kids. And both of our children are now working a 12-step program 16 years earlier and a lot less pain than we had. I have a son-in-law who's in the program. And now at Thanksgiving dinner, our Thanksgiving dinner, everybody's working a 12-step program except the 2-year-old and the 6-year-old, and they're getting schooled. I'd like to thank all of our speakers for coming today.